Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report Jordan Alessio, who's the chief economist at ABC Bullion, a very leading Australian precious metals and bullion specialist. Jordan, I'm very delighted he could join us because his background gives a very brings a unique perspective to the role of gold and silver in an integrated portfolio strategy. He's worked in the financial industry in both Sydney and London. He's run a successful investment bank. He's the author of a new book, Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, Debt for Free. He holds both a BA and a graduate diploma in investment and finance. But he also has a diploma in financial planning. So we can look at this from the point of view of an individual and their investments in balance sheet and see gold and silver as an integrated piece. And that's very unusual in the precious metals market to have someone who can command an executive position at a place like ABC Bullion and also have that background. Now, because I've just come from Australia and because he's there and in the middle of everything going on in Asia, I've also asked him to talk tonight about the Australian economy, which is clearly plays a very important role in the precious metals market. And he's prepared some slides. So before I bring him on, I want you to click and make sure you open the slides available in the subscriber section, because it'll help you tremendously. And he's prepared quite a presentation for us. So Jordan, it's great to hear your voice again. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's a real pleasure to join you. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while, and yeah, I think it's a good time to be having a chat. Obviously, what's happening in China and the implications for Australia and Australian precious metal investors are sort of highly relevant to people all around the world. You know, we've certainly had a lot of people asking us about investment in gold and silver and holding it in a country like Australia, and I think there's always been a bit of a fascination with what's happening down here, because we did seem to sail through the first part of the GFC, certainly in a much stronger fashion than most developed world economies. So, you know, I think people see the sort of wheels coming off down here. It's quite interesting and makes people sort of pay attention.
Well, let's start with the Australian economy. What's going on in Australia? How does it fit in with what's going on in Asia? Tell us, walk us through Australia.
Yeah, sure, Catherine. I guess the things that single-handedly kept Australia out of going through a formal recession when the global financial crisis hit was the extraordinary stimulus that was deployed by China. And the implications that had, both on our terms of trade, in terms of the prices we were receiving for our key commodity exports, but perhaps more importantly than that, also the impact that it had on business capital investment in Australia, particularly within mining sectors. So as I'm sure a lot of people would be aware, or perhaps for those people that aren't aware, the key commodity exports for Australia are iron ore, coal, gas, and actually gold as well. And China, over the last sort of 15 years, went from being less than 10 to taking up more than 30% of all of our exports. And Japan is always and still remains an important export destination for us as well. So what we saw, I guess, at the peak of the business capital investment cycle was that there was roughly $160 billion a year of investment happening by businesses in this country, more than half of which was just coming from the mining sector alone. But since our terms of trade peaked back in 2011, and since the price of iron ore, coal, obviously gold as well, has pulled back, we've seen a drastic reduction in capital investment plans and in actual capital investment in Australia, such that by next year, the number is probably going to be closer to $100 billion, and look, that might end up even being optimistic. So we're talking a roughly $60 billion decline, which is roughly 3% of GDP, 3.5 to 4%, coming out of the Aussie economy. Plus, we've also got now the decline in our terms of trade, because the price we're getting paid for these exports has declined precipitously. So that is really the key challenge that we are facing. And the really troubling thing is that we're not seeing any kind of rebalancing in the Australian economy, even though interest rates are at record lows at just 2%. So the great hope of the government and of the Reserve Bank down here was that as mining investment tailed off, that there would be a large increase in investment in manufacturing and in services. Australia's obviously still a heavily services-focused economy. But as one of the slides that I've prepared shows, there's actually still very significant declines planned in manufacturing and in services, rather than there being an uptick in business investment in these parts of the economy. For example, we've got the majority of the Australian car industry shutting down by 2017, and even housing construction, which had been something of a bright spot, is set to peak this year, and we're going to see declines in housing construction going forward. So, the Australian economy faces a number of headwinds going forward, and what's going on with business investment is clearly the most alarming one.
Now, I was amazed because I expected things to be slower when I got down to Sydney, and just from walking, talking with people, it seemed much stronger than I had expected. So the slowdown, I think, is just coming now. Is that the case?
Yeah, look, it is, Catherine, and I think it's also important to separate Sydney from Australia. I mean, I think most people are are very well aware that London is not the United Kingdom, New York and Washington is not the United States, Sydney is not Australia.
Sydney's a financial capital. It's got quite a housing bubble right now.
That's right. It's the financial capital. It is also the home for foreign money is coming in from China and from other parts of Asia, and that is a not insignificant factor. What you're seeing in Sydney is probably a very poor representation of what is going on in the broader economy. I obviously work and live in Sydney, and I see it myself. But the truly amazing thing, Catherine, if you sort of get outside of the CBD or even the inner suburbs, I live in a relatively affluent suburb called Balmain, which is sort of 20 minutes out of the CBD on a bad day, 15 minutes on a good day. And what we're seeing there is house prices hit record after record in terms of what they're trading for, whilst at the same time, the heart of actual enterprise, which is a street called Darling Street in Balmain, almost every week there's a new business shutting down. So we're seeing this colossal asset price inflation, whilst at the same time, the real economy is actually clearly declining, even in what is an otherwise affluent suburb.
Right. Okay, so the superannuations. Go ahead. You go.
No, you go, Catherine, sorry.
I was going to ask, let's just follow along with your slide. So walk us through.
Okay, so I think, we've obviously talked about business capital investment. If we moved on, there's a great news site in Australia or headlined out of Australia called Macro Business, who produce some fantastic slides on what's really happening in the Aussie economy. And I've shared one here for your viewers, which looks at the share of outstanding private sector credit. And it breaks it down between what's been lent for housing, what's been lent to businesses, and what's been lent in personal loans. So we're talking credit cards and the like. And, what is really clear, if you look at that chart, is how the composition of bank lending has changed over the last 25 years, pretty much since we last had a recession. Back at the end of or the start of the 90s, essentially 65 out of every $100 the banks were lending was going to productive enterprise. Only around $25 was going towards home prices and asset speculation. And as you can see, over the last 25 years, those numbers have almost completely reversed. such
right.
the great majority of bank lending now is purely going to fund asset speculation and home ownership. And part of that is to do with, I guess, the seemingly impregnable run that Australian housing has been on over that period. It also has to do with how the banks were able to convince the regulators that any money they had lent towards housing was lower risk than business loans, and therefore they're effectively able to sweat their capital much harder if they push more of their dollars into housing. So that's been another factor as well. Either way, though, the implications for the Australian economy are quite troubling, because we've got a banking sector that is overwhelmingly focused on lending to the Australian housing market, which is already valued at well over $5 trillion. It's already the cornerstone of Australia's wealth. And they're very hesitant to lend to private businesses, which is ultimately what we need them to do if we're going to have business investment, if we're going to have a pickup in employment and wage growth and the like. So, that is a real challenge. It also poses a potential systemic risk to the Australian financial system if, for whatever reason, there is a major sort of downturn in our housing market. Our banks are going to be completely reliant on government funding and or emergency lending from the Reserve Bank to keep the doors open. There's a something that might be of interest to your listeners. About a month ago, there was a really interesting report out that looked at the big four banks in America and how their assets were now worth something like 50% of American GDP, and how that number has right. increased since the global financial crisis. So, you know, too big to fail had become even bigger. It was the implication of that research looking in America. In Australia, the assets of our big four banks are well over 200% of GDP. So they are, on a relative basis, four times larger than what the yeah. four in America are. And that is why that's where the whole sort of threats around systemic risk come in. If heaven forbid, there is a sort of major turmoil in the Australian housing market.
I was struck by how centralized the banking sector is. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a real issue. I mean, in a way, it sort of reminds me of I'm not forecasting, you know, a housing price, you know, an imminent housing price collapse or anything like that. I do believe it's a bubble. I do think Australian investors are making the worst possible investment decision, you know, buying into the average house in Australia with where yields are now. That doesn't mean I'm forecasting an imminent, housing collapse or bust. But it sort of reminds me of, you know, what was happening in Ireland several years ago. And the implications are, or the scary thing is that, you know, if anything happens to our major banks, there is absolutely no question that they would have to be, if not nationalised, their banks would their debts and their liabilities would have to be explicitly covered by, you know, Australia as a sovereign and by the government. They are already
right.
implicitly covered. Ratings agencies are very clear on that when they talk about, you know, the Australian budget deficit and Australian government gross or net debt to GDP, and why if it goes over 30%, there'd potentially be a sovereign downgrade, because it is so obvious that our banks are effectively riding off the health of the sovereign state itself, and that obviously leads to, you know, another area of concern, which is whilst Australian sort of gross and even net government debt are obviously no major problem now. I've put a couple of charts in there or a couple of tables on the Australian budget to sort of highlight what has been happening here in the last few years, where it has now become the norm to run, you know, $40, $48, $40, $35 billion deficits every single year. Now, you know, as most governments do, Catherine, you know, they tend to report, their underlying deficit as a percentage of GDP. Because it doesn't sound too bad when you say 2% of GDP. Yeah, but when you run a $40 billion deficit, the gap between taxes and the gap between revenue is actually around 15%. So that's the scale of the change.
Right. You're building up an infrastructure of bad behavior and bad habits.
Absolutely. And look, the government, when they released their last budget in May, made a real song and dance about the fact that they think they will almost close the deficit by the end of the decade. They think they'll get the deficit down to about $7 billion for underlying cash balance, as you can see in those tables there. But the forecasts that they used to come up with those numbers were wildly optimistic. Obviously, we spoke before about the declines in business capital investment in Australia. They're forecasting growth in the non-mining sector of 2%, 4%, nearly 8% by 2015-2017. That is just not going to happen. They also expect to actually grow federal government revenue by 20% between now and 2019. That is simply not going to happen in an environment where unemployment's likely to rise, where real wage growth is negative. So, when I look at those budget deficit numbers, they're already alarming. The reality is they're going to be far worse than what Treasury has forecast. And like every sovereign around the world with an aging population, if you look at the next chart, you can see that the growth in spending is all in the wrong areas. So I've sort of highlighted the size of the health budget and the size of the social services budget as they stand today. They already make up between the two of them 45% of total expenditure. And you can see that particularly when we look at social services, spending there is forecast to grow by at least 15% between now and effectively the end of the decade. So much like the rest of the developed world with an aging population, we're going to see massive increases in outflows that the government is going to have to honour with the pension and the like. Also, the health burden will rise with an aging population as well. You can see that we've got, increases in spending on the environment. That doesn't really matter. I'm not saying the environment doesn't matter, but the amount of money that they spend on the environment as a percentage of the total is largely insignificant. When I look at health and social services, as I've sort of tried to say there, the growth in spending is all in the wrong areas. It's not growth in terms of infrastructure or things like that. And that's actually been quite interesting because the current government, when they ran for office, were very keen, and Tony Abbott, our current Prime Minister, was very keen to be seen and referred to as the infrastructure Prime Minister. The reality is that there hasn't been any noticeable increase in infrastructure spending, and what increase there has been in many cases poorly targeted and the sort of traditional pork barreling type that favours certain constituencies or key areas where the swing voter is more valuable. So that's another concern for Australia as well. And I think probably the next couple of slides might be pretty interesting as well for viewers, just to understand the breakdown of what we call wealth in Australia. And I'll share some information here, and then maybe a couple of anecdotes as well. That next slide, slide number 7, which is titled Australian Wealth, highlights pretty clearly that nearly 80% of Australia's wealth is trapped either inside an owner-occupied home or inside of superannuation. And if we look at superannuation first, and then I'll talk about that in detail a couple of times, firstly, nobody can touch that until they meet what's called a condition of release, which is essentially when they retire. So, pretty much anyone under the age of 65, whilst they're building up assets inside of super, they can't actually go and spend any of that in the real economy. And look, there are major problems with how that money's invested, the fees they're being charged as well. But just more broadly, the fact is that it's not having any major impact in terms of spending in the real economy, and it is taking up 9.5% of everybody's wages. So by law, that is what people are forced to contribute into this system. So, you can make the case that in the long run, it's good for Australia to have a national pool of savings. And I believe that. I believe we should have a superannuation system. but the amount of money that's being forced into it, the fees that are being charged and the way the money is invested, absolutely none of it makes its way down to small business or, you know, private equity and the like. That is right. A real problem. But the bigger issue is, of course, what's going on with owner-occupied housing. And Australia is technically the wealthiest country on earth by median net worth. I think it's Credit Suisse do a global wealth report, and as at their last report, which is in 2014, they had Australian median net wealth at I think we were number one. I think Belgium was number two, funnily enough. And the average Australian is on paper 3 to 4 times wealthier than people in Germany and people in the United States, you name it. But the reality is, it's not spendable wealth. It's just wealth that's trapped inside your house. So, you know, if I think of my family as a classic example, you know, my auntie and uncle, they run a very successful business. They own some investment property and the like. They obviously own their own house that they live in. The increase in the value of the house that they own, though, on a day-to-day basis means absolutely nothing to them in terms of the actual decisions they make around investing in their business, around going out and spending money on a holiday or a new car or, you know, any kind of consumer discretionary spending. So this wealth is, you know, illusion is not the right word, but it doesn't actually do anything to go and stimulate the economy. And as I'll touch on later, you know, the flip side to it, or the other part of it, is of course record high private debt levels in Australia.
Right.
So that's of course the other factor. Just touching one more brief point, I won't spend much time on this this next slide, which is about the superannuation system. But what it does show is how the money is invested, both with large super funds and then also with self-managed super funds, which are the more self-directed retirement funds. That's, for example, what I have myself. And as you can see, the first and most obvious point is that when it comes to large super funds, there's absolutely no money that's been invested in precious metals. When it comes to self-managed super funds, you know, it might be, you know, 0.1 of 1% maximum has been invested in precious metals so far, and that's despite the fact that gold in Australian dollars has outperformed all of the other asset classes for the last 15 years as a whole. So, you know, much like, you know, pension funds overseas, gold is still very much an undiscovered asset for Australian investors. And to me, the great fear is when I look at how that money is invested, the overwhelming majority of it is, of course, in stocks, bonds, and cash, and all three of those markets face, you know, very, very serious headwinds going forward. If we look at cash, obviously, you know, we're already in a real negative real rate environment. In Australia, we're going to see much lower interest rates going forward. You know, I'm sure most of your viewers are very you know, well aware of how richly valued equity markets are. The Australian market is just as richly valued as a lot of other developed markets, and of course, you know, fixed income, you know, bond yields are you know, the lowest level in six centuries. So when you look at those three primary asset classes, you see, you know, a lot of risk going forward. So I do worry that a lot of people that have their wealth, well, most Australians have the majority of their financial wealth trapped inside this system. You know, I do fear that they could face a pretty significant haircut, or at the very least, a very challenging time growing wealth in the coming decade.
You know, every time you look at the Australian charts, it says the same thing we're seeing here in the United States. In other words, you are not investing your money in things that will help you produce real returns over a long period of time.
That's absolutely spot on, Catherine. It's the prioritization of asset price speculation over right. productive enterprise. And if I could make a point, I guess an anecdotal point more than anything, you mentioned at the start of this program that I've obviously published a book. Now, I wrote that book using a piece of software called Tableau, spelled T-A-B-L-O. Now, the gentleman that started Tableau, he was 19 years old when he started it. He's 21 years old now, I believe. He's a young fellow based out of Melbourne, Australia. You know, terrific entrepreneur, exactly the kind of person that we should want to be promoting and helping grow, because he's now got a business that's employing Australians, paying real wages. Now, this guy, when he wanted to go and get more funding to take his business to the next level, he didn't have a prayer of getting that money. Well, he wasn't able to raise all the funds in Australia, despite the fact we have a $2 trillion superannuation pool, despite the fact that on paper, we are the wealthiest country on earth. He was forced to go overseas and rattle the tin internationally to actually raise capital to get his business to the next level. And that is the great shame of our superannuation industry. You know, when people put their money in, it's effectively being used to bid up the price of pre-existing assets, rather right. than any of the money being used to fund the next generation of Australian entrepreneurs and Australian small businesses and the like.
Right. It's exactly the same here. You come into a neighborhood and all the businesses are putting the equivalent of 9% of their money into a retirement fund that finances all the big companies to come in and take away their market share. So you're financing you're financing the destruction of your market.
Yeah, that's not a bad way of putting it. And it's very true. And it's really sad. And look, I'm not to, as you mentioned, I'm a, you know, I've got a background in asset allocation, investment management and financial planning. So I, you know, when I used to do more of that work on a day-to-day basis, I certainly didn't say to clients that, look, you shouldn't have any of your money in blue chip stocks, or that you shouldn't have any of your money in fixed income or even in cash, you know, particularly in Australia. You know, really up until now, you still were able to earn some reasonable returns in a term deposit. But what it was about observing was that you shouldn't have all of your money invested in these places. And at a national level, at a sovereign level, and thinking about Australia as a country, there is absolutely no question that our superannuation industry and our property industry are actually detracting from our ability to productively grow. And that's not to say that there shouldn't be any money in super. It's not to say people shouldn't put any money in, but we desperately need to rethink how that money is invested and how much money people are forced to put into this system, because it is clearly inhibiting private sector growth, particularly at you know, that sort of entrepreneurial new business, small business right. level, which is, you know, which is the key to actually a prosperous economy. And you mentioned before smaller businesses losing market share and struggling. The reality is that is going to be a trend that's going to be in place, I fear, for some time in Australia. And the next few charts, the next three charts, which are the last ones that I've prepared on the Australian economy, explain, you know, very clearly why. The first one, which is chart 9, sort of shows household balance sheets and the ratio of household debt to disposable income. And again, it basically goes back to the early 90s and the start of, when we had our last recession. And you can see how much it has increased. It has, you know, just about tripled, over that time. And that's obviously been the key to, rising house prices over this period. I haven't included a chart on it, but, what is quite incredible, Catherine, is that in Australia now, even though interest rates are only 2%, the average Australian is spending a higher percentage of their disposable income servicing their mortgage than what they were back in the 90s when interest rates were above 10%. Because the amount of wow. money they've had to borrow has gone up by so much that the only reason they're able to keep the mortgages that they've got is because interest rates are at record lows. And that is why everybody, you know, even last year, Bloomberg did a survey in November of last year of Australian economists. I didn't get a chance to contribute. And 23 out of 23 of them were not forecasting any further interest rate cuts. They thought 2.5% was the low, and most of them thought the Reserve Bank would start hiking this year. As we've seen, they've actually cut interest rates 50 basis points, and now the market has turned and now sees at least one more interest rate cut by Christmas time. My view is that they will at least be 1.5% by the end of this year, early next year, and I think they'll fall as low as 1% in this cycle. And the reality is that households are so stretched now that there is no choice but to just perpetually make credit cheaper. And the other thing compounding that is highlighted with the next graph, which shows hourly pay rates, including bonuses. And you can see what has happened, in the quarter-on-quarter changes, really since 2011. There's just been a despite the volatility on a quarter-to-quarter basis, there has been a sharp drop-off now such that real wages are, in fact, or real wage growth is, in fact, negative now. And if you look at, further compounding the problem is the fact that the price Australians are having to pay for the essential items, the healthcare, the rent, the health insurance, general insurance, all of those things, petrol prices, you name it, those things are going up at a far faster rate than overall inflation. And it's captured pretty neatly in the next slide that I've showed, which looks at the breakdown of Australian household spending between essentials and discretionary spending. And again, it goes back to the start of the 1990s and our last recession. And you can see that by the middle of the 90s, Australians were having to spend, roughly 67 out of every $100 on those essentials, leaving them around about, if you look at discretionary spending, the number was about 33. That has now gone down to around about $27. So if you think about your retailer, he's now got your discretionary retailer, Catherine, in Australia. He's now, out of every
$6
that the average Australian has to spend, he's got $6 less of market share to go after, because that Australian has to spend now over $70 just paying the essentials out. And that is why we're seeing, as I mentioned before, in Balmain, where I live, almost every week or every month, another shop just shutting down because there's just not enough demand for products. So that is what is happening in the Australian economy. We've got businesses refusing to invest. We've got government already running $40 billion deficits that are going to stay that way and are going to be far worse than what they forecast. We've also got the Australian consumer who is completely tapped out. The only thing that is keeping headline Australian GDP numbers looking anything like anything reasonable and keeping us out of a formal recession is the fact that net exports are flying as we continue to expand supply of our commodity exports. But even that is a real distortion of the underlying economic truth, because the price we're receiving for those exports has absolutely collapsed and will probably continue to fall. So I've been doing a bit of media work lately with more traditional finance media in Australia here. And as I've said to them, if we don't go into a formal recession, we're going to experience recession-like conditions for years to come down here.
Right.
That's the Australian economy. I can't tell you how much it's like the American economy, but we've eaten through a lot more fat and muscle than you have. So your middle class is still much better off than ours is on a per capita basis and many other ways. So believe it or not, it's very similar, except, we're just ahead. So let's turn to the gold market, because there's a relationship between how the economy is doing and why someone might want gold. Is this your next chart, the rate cuts?
Yeah, that's right. I think that was a chart I included in my book, and it's one of the most extraordinary charts I think I've seen in the last 15 years. At the end of the day, I think even a lot of people that are bullish on gold and who would love to see a huge reduction in the interference of government in free market economies, I think there are plenty of people that understand why, when the GFC hit, there was an emergency slashing of interest rates and a move to these policy. And you can see that in terms of the jump in the percentage of industrialized economies that moved to rates near or below zero, you know, and it went from basically 10 to 50%, you know, almost instantly when the GFC hit between, you know, sort of 2007 and 2008. But I think, you know, what that chart, you know, really conclusively highlights is that we are very, very clearly in even worse shape now than what we were in 08, 09, and 2010. Because if we weren't, we would have seen central banks, you know, around the globe start to normalize policy. But of course, we haven't seen that. If anything, we've seen even, you know, more and more countries have to continually cut interest rates. I know Canada cut rates overnight. As I say, in Australia, it's only a matter of time before we slice another 25 to 50 basis points over our cash rate. And I think it just goes to show how, or highlights how addicted we are to, you know, as I've titled, you know, money for nothing and debt for free. We're trying to make money worth nothing, quite literally. And,
right.
And it, you know, it hasn't worked and it won't work. And I think that the next slide that I have included, I reckon this is probably my favourite quote of the year that I've come across so far from Jared Midnack, who runs Midnack Advisors, ex-Morgan Stanley, very, very well-respected, you know, macro commentator down here in Australia, where he said, you know, the biggest bubble out there is central bank credibility. And if Draghi was a stock, he'd be on a PE of 200, Yellen's on 100. And when that bubble pops, all hell will break loose. And then you really just want to be in cash. And that obviously relates then to, you know, the question mark then becomes, well, what kind of cash are you in? Are you in Aussie dollars? Are you in US dollars? Are you in euros? Or are you in gold? And
right.
James Grant, who's, I think, you know, probably alongside Bill Bonner, my favourite commentator, I think that comment from early 2014 is very appropriate around, you know, nothing beating a little cash in a bear market. And, of course, you know, the oldest form of cash is gold. And funnily enough, Catherine, a few weeks ago, I was at an investment conference, which was almost exclusively to do with Australian equity investing. So it was a handful of key fund managers and brokers and look, some very well-respected guys who have had fantastic track records, you know, people whose opinions I respect and listen to. And one of the guys in particular commented that he had moved his portfolio to over 40% cash now because they are expecting, you know, some blood in the streets. They do see the market as being overpriced. But my concern for people like that is, what if we don't actually see a huge market crash in nominal terms? We just see a continuation of this period where equities kind of jump around a bit. They continue to pay out some dividends, but they don't sort of do too much in nominal terms. They don't crash. They don't really rally too much further either. But if we start to see then inflation start to pick up, then that kind of value equity manager is going to be in a real bind because they're not going to want to go in and buy the market.
Jordan, they're in that bind right now. They've been in that bind for a year and a half. They're in that bind now. They've been in that bind for a year and a half. Yeah, agree.
And it's a real question, and I wonder if at some point, because the numbers for including gold as part of the cash component of your portfolio in any currency absolutely stack up. There's no question about that. And I wonder if at some point some of these managers are going to start to say, well, you know what, maybe it's worth me holding a little bit of bullion in my portfolio as another sort of cash holding.
Well, I think I told you it's happening now. One of the biggest brokers here came out with a new intelligent portfolio, you know, sort of robo-advisor, fire your advisor and just do robo. And it had 5% in precious metals. And I almost fell off my chair. I thought, well, precious metals has finally made it in. It's in the robo solution.
Absolutely. And I think that that's very interesting because there's a similar company down here that does very, very similar work, sort of robo advice. You know, you fill in your details around your risk profile and the like, and it sort of spits out a recommended portfolio. And they actually have a a 10% allocation to gold in their funds. And I've spoken to their the guy that set that up, and he's an ex-equities guy, but he he realizes the value that gold brings to a well-constructed portfolio. And I think that's a really important battle to fight and to win, because without wanting to, certainly without wanting to mention names or anything like that, but sometimes the gold industry can actually be its own worst enemy, because it only talks about gold as being sort of anti-fiat money, and people only talk about, I guess effectively financial Armageddon, and saying to people,
right,
therefore you should sell everything and put everything in gold. And look, that's just not a practical way of engaging with the great majority of people. And it's also not actually necessary. I mean, if you look at the vast majority of the better gold market commentators out there, the guys that actually do have broader credibility, most of them will generally talk about having, between 10 and 25% of your portfolio in precious metals. And certainly I find that when I speak to advisors and, we're increasingly talking to institutional fund managers down here. Inevitably when we talk to them about gold, we almost never talk about gold versus fiat money. We just don't broach the conversation in that way. We broach gold as a natural currency hedge. We broach gold as a diversifier against the stock market. We broach gold as an alternative defensive asset in an environment where cash is paying you nothing and where bonds are at their highest price in 30 years. And when we talk to people like that as portfolio, from a portfolio construction perspective, that has much better cut through, definitely with instos, but even with financial right. advisors and the like, and for your average person who has traditionally had all their money in stocks, bonds, and cash, who's starting to get a little bit uneasy, and starts to say, okay, well, how does this whole gold thing work? If we were to try and tell them, well, look, everything else is going to crash, so you should give us all your money, they're going to run a million miles. And frankly, I sort of couldn't blame them. So I think that conversation about why gold, how gold, is very important to have. And I suspect, it's going to end up being the most profitable investment they'll have in their portfolio. Because as we all know, sentiment, and I've got a chart on that, the next slide, talks about that. Sentiment is absolutely appalling towards precious metals. That headline came from Forbes, from recollection. It's about a week old, where you see a headline of the loathsome truth about gold and why it should crash 40% more. That's exactly the kind of headline you want to see when you want to buy an asset
right.
rather than sell an asset. I guarantee we will not see that kind of headline at the top of the gold bull market.
Although, you see a lot of deflationary forces, Jordan, so I never underestimate what a strong deflationary force can do to the price of any commodity. So.
Oh, look, I couldn't agree with you more, Catherine. I mean, I think if you only
right.
look at what's happened to oil, to iron ore in particular, which is a real one here for Australia to notice, copper, all of these other commodities have already been absolutely
decimated.
Absolutely yeah. beaten up. So, and I also think it's worth commenting, considering, Greece and China are in the news right now. A lot of people have been very frustrated that gold hasn't rallied off the back of these events. But it's important to remember, both in and of themselves, they are hugely deflationary events, what is happening in China and what is happening in Greece. And then if you drill into each one individually, question marks around a potential Brexit clearly bring up then question marks over the euro itself and, potential longer-term implications there. So that, in and of itself is somewhat dollar supportive, which is clearly not a good thing for gold. And then in China, Gold is one of, if not most liquid assets on the planet. So when you've got every investor being hit with a margin call, it's absolutely likely that many of them would have been liquidating gold positions just to cover, right. What they were owing on the margin side of things with their stock holdings. So I actually think gold, whilst the price action hasn't been fantastic, let's not pretend otherwise, I actually think it's held up okay in light of the fact that sentiment has been as bad as it has been. And if you look at, I'll jump a slide down to slide 16. If you look at speculative positioning now, it almost could not be better from a contrarian perspective. We've got, right. Net specs are at their lowest level in, I think, nearly a decade, according to Saxo Bank. And you can see there when you look at that chart, when you look at the, when you look at where the sort of shorts are, there's more people that are short gold now than what they were back in April 2013, December 2013, you name it. So I think from that point of view, look, absolutely, we could have one last washout in gold. There could be, if there's an arch deflationary event, of course we could see $100 come out of the price in US dollar terms. I think for Aussie investors, right. we'd be cushioned by the currency. But I think gold is starting to look really interesting now. Another chart, obviously, well, the next one that's worth pointing out is, the gold bear is getting pretty old now in terms of time. But we've been in effectively now a four-year corrective cycle. It was August, September 2011 that gold peaked at, around that 1900 mark. We're now basically 4 years into a cyclical correction. So that's, again, that's another thing that is encouraging and that I think investors should be looking at with, as an attractive thing rather than as a negative thing.
Right.
If you're looking to invest capital now. Yeah, that's my view on the market. I mean, what is the view that you have in terms of American investors towards gold right now, Catherine?
Well, there are different perspectives. If you were buying in the early 2000s, you see this as just a correction. If you got in at the top, there's a real effort to market into people and bring them in right before the top. They've had a very sort of expensive experience. And I think, a lot of the marketing here was not balanced. It was basically, saying you should put everything in gold, blah, 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 exactly as you described. So I think the situation is now coming around to one of a lot more perspective. And the way I talk to subscribers, I describe positions as both a core position and an investment position. And the charts right now are just beginning to look to me like something where you'd want to start to speculate. It's still early. So no bottom has been proved. But for a core position, you want to have a core position no matter what. It doesn't matter what the price is. Because you have a core position to protect against certain kind of scenarios. And those scenarios can happen at a moment's notice. There's no way to be prepared other than to be prepared, all the time. So, So I think you want to have a core position. And then for an investment position, I think it's still early, but I keep watching the charts daily thinking, is it yet? But it's hard not to believe it's close. And I think the thing that gives us a lot of confidence is if you look at the long-term buying from Asia at the retail level, the physical buying to me ultimately is going to contribute mightily, and I should add the central banks. So you have very strong long-term demand, which is a support to the price.
I couldn't agree more with you, Catherine. I think that, if we look at, I've got a couple of slides on this. If we maybe move to slide 19 in the presentation that I've prepared, starting with ETF holdings, look, there's no major demand coming back into the gold ETF market, but holdings have stabilized there. So again, you can see right. The huge outflows, nearly 1,000 tons in 2013, another 200 tons in 2014. And the first 6 months of this year, we've basically seen ETF holdings flat. Obviously, central banks, as you spoke about, you know, essentially switching from circa 400 tons a year of selling into the market to, you know, an average of 450 tons of buying. You know, I think that helps give us another, essentially add strength to the market. And then, you know, I think the more interesting slide is probably slide 21 that I've prepared, which is to do with sort of eastern buying. And what that chart shows is the percentage of annual physical gold demands and how it's changed from 1970 through to 2010. So if we go all the way back to 1970, you know, you can see that nearly 50% of the buying was coming out of Europe and North America, over 40%, just over 40 was coming out of Asia. By 1980, so the last, you know, I guess, bubble in precious metals, nearly 70% of the buying was out of North America, only, you know, less than 20 was out of Asia. But you can see how that has changed over the last, you know, four decades and in terms of where we are now. So, you know, we have effectively had a bull market in precious metals for the last 15 years that has outperformed every traditional asset, and it has been achieved without any widespread adoption of precious metals in Western investor portfolios. Which is
quite remarkable, isn't it?
it is. And that's also why, you know, a lot of people say, oh, central banks are going to cause the gold price to fly, or China's going to crash the US dollar and cause the gold price to fly, or Chinese retail buying will cause the gold price to fly. I don't believe any of those things. I believe with what you said, I think central bank and, let's call it, Eastern consumer pro-cyclical demands will provide support for the gold market that was not there in the 1980s, but it will ultimately be the adoption to some degree by Western investors that will get the gold market really moving again when it does happen. In fact, I was talking to...
Right, and one of the things I think is important to point out is the Western financial system did a very thorough job of persuading retail investors in the West to hold gold through paper and through their brokerage accounts.
Sure.
And I just don't see that happening in Asia. I'm not saying that there won't be some ETF buying, but you have the Chinese and very committed to physical possession of gold and silver, not through paper.
Absolutely. And look, for example, in Australia, there are certain investors, particularly within a traditional superannuation home, where they just can't buy physical gold. If they've got a self-managed super fund, they can.
Right.
If they've got a traditional superannuation fund, they can't. They might be able to buy a gold ETF. I'm not anti the – I actually think the existence of gold ETFs is good for the gold market. I think it puts
yes,
on the radar.
Yes, absolutely.
For more investors than it otherwise would. I personally, you know, do prefer to, and obviously as a business we provide, you know, real physical, you know, that we can put in allocated storage or in private vaulting depending on what the client wants. So I clearly do believe and agree that is the superior way of having gold in your portfolio. And there's very clearly a difference between having gold exposure in your portfolio and having gold in your portfolio.
Right.
So I couldn't agree with that more. But I think maybe just as a final talk around where precious metals can go and the concept of Western investors adopting gold, the last couple of slides that I've got there, one breaks down the global asset pool today, as if there was just $100 in the world. Yeah, there's obviously well over, you know, $250 trillion. But you know, $250 trillion is a number that doesn't mean anything to anyone except Janet Yellen. So, you know, you can break it down into a number that, you know, is easily identifiable. And I've used Australian currency there. But, you know, if we look at the market, and this is based on a breakdown from Incrementum Agger a couple of years ago, you can see that there's, you know, over $50 in bonds and debt securities, 37 in equities and listed stocks, about $10 in cash and alternatives. And, you know, it's actually less than one, you know, effectively $1 that's sitting in gold today, which is an extraordinary number when, again, we come back to the last 15 years of gold outperforming everything, yet it's only at best 1% of investors' assets, at best one. The reality is it would actually be lower than that. So you start to wonder, God, if 5 or 10% of the money goes into gold, where does the price go? And I guess that then translates to the next slide that I've presented, which is, John Exeter and Exeter's pyramid, which I think is one of the really fantastic ways of visualizing the breakdown of asset markets and gold's role at the base of that pyramid. And if we really break it down, Catherine, by implementing ZIRP, by implementing negative interest rate policy, by printing or creating trillions of dollars of QE, what governments and central banks have effectively done is said there is no longer going to be a risk-free rate of return in paper money itself. And therefore, right, we're going to make that a frying pan. So we're going to make you go out into the fire. We're going to make you go up the pyramid into T-bills, into bonds, into listed stocks, into derivatives, into commodity, into industrial commodities. And we're basically never going to allow you to feel comfortable with where your money's invested because it'll never be safe. You're going to have to constantly take risk. And what I try and say to investors is, look, that's fine to do that with a portion of your portfolio, but rather than going out of the frying pan of paper money and into the fire of all of these speculative assets that have credit risk, why not put a portion of your money on the other side of the of paper money or below paper money on the pyramid into physical precious metals? Because as that chart highlights there, or as the slide highlights, as it stands today, there's only $1 out of every 100 in gold. But at the height of every other precious metal market, gold and gold mining companies have been roughly 20% of global financial assets. So if we get a quarter of a way there, there is no other listed asset market that provides anywhere near that kind of bang for your buck or anywhere near that kind of potential return on invested capital. And that to me is probably the final reason why investors should have that core exposure to precious metals now. It's the primary reason is wealth protection, but there is actually a very good chance you're going to get a fantastic payoff on invested capital, especially if you're dollar cost averaging into the market now when it has been completely beaten down and is completely unloved.
Jordan, what do you think will happen if interest rates, if the Fed does raise interest rates, and obviously I don't think they'll do much, say 25 to 50 basis points, what is that going to do to precious metals? How tough could that be on prices? And should we wait for it?
I think in the short term, Catherine, it's clearly detracting from sentiment, a little bit like all the talk of taper and the end of QE hurt gold as well. It was the actual talk about doing it that manifested itself in lower prices. The actual period through which they were doing it, and clearly in the last handful of months or year or so that they haven't been printing money in the US, gold has actually been sort of range bound rather than collapsing. So I think the talk of it is going to hinder. I think when it happens, it actually won't have much of an impact on gold at all. And funnily enough, Catherine, I was doing some research on this with a colleague of mine recently, and we were talking about the myths around investing in gold, and one of them being, obviously nominal rate hikes are the absolute bane of gold's existence because of rising opportunity costs. And I'd encourage your viewers to actually go and get, monthly gold price returns and also monthly moves in the Fed funds rate from 1970 through to today. And what they will find is that between 1970 and 1974, between 1976 and 1980, and between about 2002 and 2007, those are three of the most aggressive Fed rate hiking cycles on record, and they are three of the most incredible periods of gold price appreciation on record as well. So this idea that nominal rate hikes are bad for gold, whilst on the surface there is a logic to it, has been completely disproved by market history. So I actually think that I actually think, you know, we talk about black swans and unexpected events being catalysts for markets to move. I say bring on a Fed rate hike because I think it actually could be bullish for gold.
Really? Well, that one I hadn't considered, but I'm open. Jordan, you persuaded me. I'm open. Now, speaking of which, you go.
I will send you a slide, which I'm very happy for you to include or provide to your members and your people that subscribe to Solari, which will actually highlight, as I say, those three periods and where uh-huh. the funds rate went from and to, and what actually happened to gold in those environments as well.
I would love to see that. We will post that in the subscriber area. Thank you for it. Now, we're running out of time, so I have to turn you. We do have some subscribers who are interested in learning what you offer to both. So we're talking now about people who are in New Zealand, Australia, and the United States. What does ABC Bullion, particularly Vaulted Solutions?
Sure. So, yeah, look, we do deal with clients, obviously the majority of our client base is Australia, but we deal with clients from all over the world, up in Asia, North America, and Europe. So ABC Bullion can do one of two things effectively to provide an allocated bullion solution. The first is that the clients can obviously buy and store direct with ABC. So as you may be aware, ABC Bullion actually owns its own gold refinery. We produce investment-grade gold bars. Our kilo bar, which is our signature product for investors, comes with its own serial numbers, its own certificates of authenticity. We work with, you know, some of Australia's largest gold miners in terms of where we get our gold from. So a lot of overseas investors like buying those gold bars, and then they will put them in allocated storage with ABC Bullion. The second option, which is increasingly attractive to clients as well, is that we can provide a through our private vaulting arm. So we have a sister company called Custodian Vaults, which is a non-bank purpose-built bullion vaulting facility located in Sydney, which is very attractive to international investors because they like the idea of having non-bank vaulted gold in Australia. And what we can do for clients there is we can basically obviously sell them, you know, precious metals that they want to invest in. And then we can also arrange a private box down there where they can actually have their metal stored. And we've all got an independent party who can effectively act in terms of opening their box and putting their metal in there for them. We've had a relationship with Grant Thornton there. So basically the client can then effectively appoint them to act as the agent opening their box and making sure the gold is safely secured in there. So those are the two ways we tend to work with international clients. And absolutely, if you've got people that would like to shoot me a note, I know you can provide them with my contact details. I'd be very happy to talk through that with them in person.
Okay. Well, can you just give your email, your contact information here, or would you like us to post it in the subscriber area?
Oh, look, you can do both, but yeah, absolutely. My email address is Jordan, Jordan. Elisio, Elisio, at abcbullion.com.au. And ABC Bullion is all one word. So I'm very, very easy to find. I'm also very active on, relatively active on Twitter and LinkedIn and other social media. So I'm a pretty easy guy to find if people want to talk further about our solutions for international investors.
Well, obviously you don't have to come down to Sydney to do the Vaulted Solutions, which is wonderful, but I would just say that I recommend a trip. It's very much fun to meet the ABC Bullion team. Well, Jordan, I can't thank you enough for joining us. Could you just point us again to your website for the new book?
Yeah, absolutely. So the website for the new book is actually just titled www.moneyfornothingdebtforfree.com.au, and it's available to purchase either via Amazon or via the Apple iBook store. It's basically $10 to download it. I think people will find it a really interesting read. It looks at a number of topics that are tracking the build-up of debt in developed market economies pretty much from the 50s to now. And how much of it went to housing, the role the government played in that, how much of it was pure consumer credit. It then looks at the sort of current state of the debt position, not only in developed market economies, but also in China, the role that the aging population will play, what I call the challenge of big government, and then a real look at where the global economy is today, a little special focus on Australia for Australian investors, and then the implications for investing, protecting and growing capital through what are going to be some very difficult years. So it's full of sort of practical tips as well as highlighting the challenges ahead.
Yeah, it's a friend of mine who always says our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism. But dire is the appropriate word. Well, Jordan, I can't thank you enough. This has been terrific. We will have your contact information, the slides up on the blog, and I'm sure if people have questions, they can follow up directly. So you have a wonderful day in Sydney, Australia, and give our best to the ABC Bullion team, okay?
Will do, Catherine. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.